Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First application of today, K-Image Map Editor. I didn't know what this was at first. I thought it was going to be another cute plugin. It's not. It is an HTML editor that creates image maps. An image map is, if you've ever seen on the internet, an image that when you roll over the image in different areas, you trigger different events. So for instance, maybe it's an image of, I don't know, a box. And if you hover over the box, then you realize you can click on it and it'll open up what's in the box and you'll be able to see what's inside or whatever. So if you've ever seen those kinds of images on the internet, this is what creates, or this is a tool that you can use to create that. And what that is, like I say, it's an image map, or really an HTML map entity, which uses screen coordinates to define different hotspots within that page. And you can use, it can use HTML, it can trigger, or it could use JavaScript. Essentially, you're defining areas, active areas, purely by coordinates. You can do that yourself. You can create a map element in HTML, set your coordinates, put a map, an image map to that, and it can happen. You can do it yourself. But this tool makes it a very graphical experience. I gotta say, it's really, really nice if you choose to do that sort of thing. Now, modern HTML, luckily, the image map thing, at least in Firefox, it detects those coordinates essentially as buttons. So if you're using a web browser exclusively with a keyboard, not using your mouse, maybe because you can't see the image, or you just can't be bothered to pick up your mouse, then this when you tab through an interface in your web browser, those coordinates, they're treated as distinct elements. So on one hand, that's a good thing. On the other hand, that can be a little bit bothersome, because if you've got like 20 things in this hidden in an image, then you have to tab through 20 things to get down to some information that you want, or whatever. So whether that's the best way to organize information, I think is up for a very reasonable debate, but there's probably use cases for it. And this tool, K-Image Map Editor, helps you create it. Now, I will admit that, and maybe this is just the basic use case, but for whatever reason, when you go to create an image map, there are several steps more than I would have expected. I would expect in an application designed to create image maps that a lot of the image map features would trigger by default, but for whatever reason they do not. And there may be a very good reason for that. I don't use this application myself often enough, well, ever, until I had to learn it for this very episode. I don't use this application. I don't do image maps really. I just don't have the need to do that in real life. So there may be a use case where its workflow makes a lot of sense. But for me, I felt that the workflow was just had a couple of steps in it that didn't quite feel intuitive. But that's okay, because it's well documented. And when I say well documented, I mean it's a one-page user manual. It's really simple. So it's not, it isn't impossible to grasp. It's just you do need to know a couple of steps. So let's go through it really quick. You launch K-Image Map Editor from your menu, your K-Menu, as usual. You launch it, and then you open an image file. It can be a PNG, a JPEG, a GIF. I don't know if it can be a WebP or not. I didn't try. It's not listed in the docs, so maybe not. But you open up an image, and you can just drag and drop an image in there. And now you've got an image loaded in K-Image Map Editor. Here's one step that I felt was a little bit non-intuitive. You have to manually add an image map element or object by going to the map menu and then selecting new map. Once again, I would have thought that if I just opened up a new menu or a new image in this application, I would have expected a new map to have been applied automatically. But like I say, maybe there's a good reason for not doing that. Either way, go to map, select new map, and it creates, although you won't really know it, I mean, you might notice it in one of the side palettes. There's a little Docker dialog box, whatever we call them now. Or not a dialog box, a panel over in the left by default with the maps, the active maps showing, being listed. So yeah, it's weird that it's not done automatically. The first time I tried this, I felt like it was being done automatically, but there's another step later that isn't done automatically. So I don't know, it's a little bit confusing. Anyway, so we've got this thing, we've gone map, new map, and then you name the map. Let's just call it my map. So now you've got a toolbar at the top of the window, and hidden away within this toolbar, there are some shapes. And so it depends on the size of your window. If you have a fairly, like a half screen window or something, you may not see the entire toolbar. I don't know why the shape tools are added to the main toolbar. I felt that was a little bit of a strange call. I strongly suggest, if you're going to use this frequently, to just switch over probably to icons only, at least for some of the elements, like your saves and your new file, your undo, your cut, copy, paste, that sort of thing. I would just go icon only. And the way that you do that is you right click in that toolbar, go to icon size, text position, icons only. That turns off the text. Oh, wait a minute. These are separate. No, they're not. They're not. They're just separated by separators. Okay. That's what I thought. Unless they're locked and they are separate. Are they separate? They are separate. Okay. I would either hide the text as I've just described, or unlock your toolbars and move some of those toolbars around. So I've just now moved my shape toolbar and my selection editor, my cursor to the bottom of the window. You could put it on the side or something like that. Who knows? But anyway, now you've got an image, you've got a map. There are shapes. Take a shape, choose your shape. It could be a circle, it could be a hexagon, it could be a rectangle, or it can even be a freehand drawing, and just draw a shape over the area that you want to be your new hotspot. It's actually called an area tag, apparently. When you do that, after you draw your shape over the area of the image that you want to be active, a menu pops up, or a dialog box rather, pops up. And there are several attributes that you can assign to this, what's going to become a link. The general assumption is that you've just created an href. So let's say that we want, for the href, we're going to just put http://example.com. Alt text, I'll just put this is some alt text. I mean, that's not useful. I wouldn't do that in real life, but I don't, this image is completely random. Target. I'm going to do _blank. That tells your web browser to open whatever we've just triggered in a new window, or a new tab, really, is what it usually defaults to. And then title, and I'll put this as some title. Okay, you don't have to stop there. You can go over to the coordinates and manually adjust them, or you can go over to the JavaScript area and put in some JavaScript. So I'm going to just put alert, parentheses, quote, you've pressed my button. That's a pressed my button. Is that push? No, pushed. You have pushed my button. That's the expression in English, that there's an implication, close quote, close parentheses, and of course, semicolon at the end. You have pushed my button in English, has an implication of being annoyed by someone. You've really pushed my button. That's what we say sometimes. Okay, so we've got image, map, editor. We've got our image, we've filled out our little magic form, and now here's the other very, for me, bizarrely unintuitive step that apparently you have to do. And that is, you go to image, edit, use map, and then you have to tell this thing that you want it to use my map. It's got a little drop-down dialog box, and so you have to kind of tell it explicitly to use the map that you've created for it. I just feel like that's so weird, because why else would I be creating this image? Like, at the least, I think that should be the default. Anyway, I'm going to click save now. A little floppy disk icon up in the toolbar. You could go to file, save, obviously, instead. And now I'm going to go out to my Dolphin file manager, click on example.html, and here we are. So I'm running my mouse over the image, and it turns into a little pointy finger over this one area, kind of in the middle of the image where I put my hotspot. And if I'm rolling over it, if I pause on it, eventually a little title box pops up. It says this is some title, and my status bar shows that the destination of this is example.com. So now I'm going to click on it. I should see a little pop-up window that says, you've really pushed my button. You've pushed my button. And I say okay to that. And then once I say okay to that, it pops up with an example domain screen, which of course is example.com. And that's KImage Map Editor. Honestly, there's probably a lot, some more that you can do with that. But that's the tutorial provided by the documentation. And if you look at it, I'm going to discard those changes. If you look at the application, look at the documentation, I don't think there's a whole lot more you can do with it. I think that's the purpose of the thing. That's the application. That's what it does. That's the one thing that it does. It does it well. It really works. Yeah, and it does do it well, honestly. It is quite satisfactory. Like, I don't need a whole lot out of a K image, out of an image map myself, but it's really clean. And by clean, I mean, the code that it generates is really, really nice. If you can open up the HTML in a text editor, I've just opened it in Emacs here, image source equals path to my image, use map equals hash my map, map name equals my map. So there we go. We've married those two elements together. Area shape is a rectangle, target blank. Title, this is some title, href equals example.com, on click equals alert, you've pushed my button, this is some alt text, coordinates, and then it lists the coordinates. So yeah, that seems to all work correctly. It closes the map, and it's just nice. You know, you don't have a whole bunch of excess code. It is just the code that you have created. So that's a really useful thing, I think. I think that's a really neat little application that I never really looked for before, because like I say, I just, in real life, I don't have the need for image maps. But if you do, then this is a really nice way to do it. And I mean, look, I don't know what the modern tool set is for GUI web development anymore. Hopefully, they're far and few between, because the ones that existed in the past that I was familiar with were just rubbish. You know, things like Dreamweaver and Photoshop, cutting images up in Photoshop. I mean, it was miserable, but people did it for a long time, and I guess they thought that was okay. And this is really nice. KImage Map Editor, just comparatively a very, very elegant solution. Yes, there are a couple of extra steps in there that I don't feel are very intuitive. Again, there may be a use case where they become really, really not annoying. This is sometimes what seems like an extra step to the casual user is something, it is better than a default that the power user has to keep changing or sometimes will save by mistake because that was the default that you forgot was made default or something like that. So either way, I think that image, K image map editor, I think it's a good little application, and I like how focused it is. I don't want to lean too much in the cliche of, oh, Linux applications must only do one thing. I get that GUI applications do many things, but this really is. I mean, it's a very specific task that it does, and I quite like it. Next up is K IMAP. IMAP is an email protocol, and KIMAP is an API for the handling of IMAP data. So I guess I should look at the listing here, but you can probably more or less guess what this is going to consist of, and you'd probably be right. It's a bunch of user include KF5 stuff, so it's a bunch of header files, and your typical translation files. That's it. So this is for stuff the KDE framework, for KDE developers rather, to use to interface to interface with IMAP. So I imagine that the primary user of this is going to be KMail, Contact. KMail more specifically. I think that's probably where we're seeing most of this, the usage of this. But I mean, if you wanted to create an email client with Qt and KDE frameworks, these are functions that you could use so that you don't have to write the code to parse all that yourself. I hate to belabor this. I probably say this every time I come across a KDE framework, but if you've ever dabbled at all in programming beyond literally creating your own thing, I feel like there are two kind of stages, or probably more than that, but let's really broadly, let's say there are two stages of being a programmer, a hobby level programmer. One is where you're making cool stuff happen through sort of brute force. You're using the code that you've learned, and maybe you're coming up with some really cool solutions, but it's all coming from your fingertips. Like that's where it's happening. But then at some point you start to understand, well, I should say, you think that's where it's all happening because you're typing all those words. Now, of course, in reality, you're not making it all happen probably. You're almost certainly including or importing or requiring or whatever the keyword your language uses. You're importing libraries, but to you, that's just part of the language because it's just built-in libraries of that language. So you don't understand really that you're inheriting a bunch of code for free when you import rand for your random number generator or import time or whatever you're importing. To you, that's just your language. But then at some point in your programming life, you start to transition into an awareness that there's a bunch of other libraries out there, and you start really, really understanding that you're getting a bunch of code for free because you're importing this library. And I feel like that's a real crossover point, because then you really start to understand how lazy you can be and how good it is to be lazy, because you don't really want to reinvent that stuff. That's not effective. It's not efficient. That's what I was trying to say. It's not effective sometimes, because it might be effective at first, but then as people use your application, you see all of the edge cases that you didn't account for while re-implementing something that someone else has already invented. So that's a big deal. And I feel like KDE frameworks, if you have gotten into that second branch of programming where you really understand truly that there's libraries out there that give you code for free, they're just taking your keyboard away from you and it's typing a bunch of code in, hundreds, thousands of lines of code with logic that you didn't have to figure out, with edge cases that you don't have to account for, and it's there. Now it's in your code. It's kind of cool. And I almost wish there was a way, and I mean there is a way, but I almost wish there was a sort of a default, sort of easy, almost unavoidable way when you run your first Python program, instead of just, somehow maybe it could just spit out really quick, here's what your code actually looks like. Even if it's just a print hello world, like here's all the stuff that you just got for free just to spit out hello world into someone's terminal. And instead of three lines, it's more like 300 lines. I think that could help people maybe really understand what they're getting when they use a library. And I'm not saying that like people need to understand and be grateful. I'm just saying, I think there's a weird gap in the concept of, well, this is the code that I write, and this is the stuff that just happens magically. And magic is not good. Like you don't want that in computing. You want stuff to be understood. And so that's what I'm trying to solve there with this imaginary thought exercise. Anyway, that's the frameworks. That's KDE frameworks. Gives you a lot of cool code for free. And I imagine that if I was programming something with Qt and KDE, I would really appreciate KIMAP. Well, I should say if I'm programming something that needs to interface with KIMAP, I would. Time for coffee. You get yours, I'll get mine. Meet back here, finish up the episode. Okay, I'm here with coffee. I hope that you've got your coffee. Let's get back to the show. And speaking of coffee, actually, I got a comment from a listener on Mastodon. This is from Ectasis. Ectasis says, "Hi, been listening to old episodes with lots of coffee talk. Got me wondering if you only buy fair trade labeled coffee or what your thoughts on fair trade are." I didn't actually catch that "or" originally. In my head, that was "and." Anyway, I don't know a lot about fair trade. I know that it is a label, an industry term that gets labeled on coffee to, as far as I know, represent some kind of assurance to a consumer that the product you are consuming was paid for and has dealt with farms or vendors who do things, quote, ethically. And I don't like the level of abstraction from where we are getting things from. I don't know a solution to it though. So taking all of it at its word, just to assume that fair trade is exactly what it says, which is that it ensures that the people harvesting coffee beans are being treated well. And again, I don't know what that means. Like, what does "well" mean? I don't know. So treated well, being paid with a fair amount, that sort of thing. Taking it at its word, I am fortunate to be in a financial situation right now, at least. Things change. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. But right now, I'm in a financial situation where I can very conveniently, without even giving it a second thought, support exclusively fair trade coffee. Meaning, when I go to the store, the brands I have to choose from are marked as fair trade brands. The coffee that I purchase for myself is coffee that's being purchased at reasonable market rates so that everyone involved is paid equally and fairly and all these other things. Now, I don't for a minute believe that it's completely a perfect system because there are very few perfect systems, especially when money and production is involved. But ideally, buying fair trade is at least better than buying not fair trade. Having said that, however, I'm imagining that the people harvesting coffee beans are not paid what they're worth because people who harvest food in general aren't being paid what they're worth. There's a lot of sort of imbalance in the world, and that's unfortunate. There are whole countries where the workforce is almost wholly oppressed, and yet that same workforce completely supports their country that is oppressing them. They are happy to be there. They will ardently defend it. They will even sign up to armed forces to go try to spread the way of their country to other countries by force. So, yeah, there are problems, but I feel like that's kind of a defeatist attitude, right? Instead, let's just assume that fair trade is doing good in the world, and luckily right now I'm able to support fair trade. That's what I've got for you. I don't know if that's really acceptable. It's not wholly satisfactory to me, but that's what I've got. I would love to know more about this too, because I don't like to sound or be or feel defeatist because I don't think that that's very constructive. But at the same time, I also think it's important to recognize that just because some marketing entity somewhere said that it's better to get the box with a green label on it than a box with a blue label on it, I don't want to pretend like that's just a guarantee and no more thought is required. Because I don't know any coffee farmers, and if I do know any coffee farmers, for instance, listening to this podcast, and you want to tell me your opinion on fair trade, I would be all ears. I'd be very interested in actually hearing what kind of change or difference that is making. Now let's look at K Info Center. This is one of my honest to goodness favorite applications on Linux at all. K Info Center. I am not kidding you. I have this pinned to my KDE panel. I love this application. K Info Center it's an application that aggregates a bunch of information about your system all in one place for every user. Any user who wants to see this stuff can click on the K Info Center and get all kinds of information about their system. And the reason this is one of my favorite applications on Linux at all is because I really honestly believe This is important information for every user to have really easy access to, and it almost makes me angry when it's obfuscated in any way. And I know that there are ways, there are always ways to get this information. I understand that. I realize you can just go to cat/proc CPU info and get a big dump of information about your CPU. I realize that you can do LSPCI and then like maybe sort of, apparently not without sudo, I can't LSPCI and get a bunch of information about all the different things plugged into all of the different ports of your computer. And I guess you could do like a grep, I don't know what, VGA maybe, to get some information about, grep VGA to get some information about your graphics card. I know you can do free and free-m and all these, you can do all of that. It's there. I know that there are other applications like INXI and what is it, Screen Fetch, I think. So yeah, there are lots of options and I understand that, but I don't know that all of those options are really easy for every user. And I don't know that those options deliver the information in a way that every user finds useful. And so I really like K-Info Center. The first time I think I saw K-Info Center, or maybe I'm just conflating a couple of different things, but I know that Magia, for instance, or when I saw it, it would have been Mandriva still. I know that they had like a sort of a, get information on your computer panel at one point. And I used to love that. Really just loved it. And then eventually I found K-Info Center and fell in love with it. So when you launch K-Info Center, and again, you can do that just from, just type in Info Center. There it is, Info Center in your K menu. When you launch it, it starts with this little default summary screen just called About This System. And here it is. It's got the Slackware logo, Slackware 15.0, Slackware.com. Softwares, KDE Plasma version 5.23.5, KDE Framework version 5.90.9.0, Qt version 5.15.3, Kernel version 5.15.38, Graphics Platform X11, Hardware, Processors 12, AMD Ryzen 5 5600X 6 Core Processor, and so on. So lots and lots of information. I can even copy all of that information to my clipboard. Now I have all that, all the basic info. Someone using a computer, you ask, give me information about your system. You tell them to go to K-Info Center, copy that to their keyboard. They have it. They can paste it into an email. Done. No screenshots, nothing. It's just everything that they saw, you now have in an email. But that's not all. That's just the summary screen. There's also a memory screen that shows you your total physical memory, the free physical memory, shared memory, disk buffers, disk cache, total swap memory. It gives you little bar charts of how that memory is being used. Here's a disk cache of 65%, free is 8%, application data is 25%, and so on. You can look at the energy information about your computer. I mean, especially useful if there's a battery in your computer, which there isn't here. Storage drives, you see all of your different hard drives. You see what size they are. You see their locations of them. Processors, again, you see all the processor information, how many cores you have, DMA channels, IEEE 1394 devices, none of those, IO ports, interrupts, PCI, smart status, USB devices, graphics, you see all the information about your graphics card, about which graphic card you actually have, what the specifications about it are, what OpenGL version it is using, what Vulkan, all the Vulkan information, the X server information, and it just goes on and on. And then there's, I forgot, network. There's a network one as well. And you get all of the, you want someone's IP address? They can find their IP address, finally. They can just go to network, and then it goes by default to network interfaces, and it shows all the different interfaces. And there are a lot of them, admittedly, right now in my system, because a lot of these are tunnel devices, virtual bridges going to a virtual machine. Not a big deal. You just tell them to look for the one that starts with 10.0 or the one that starts with 192.168 or what, however you've got things configured, where you ask them for the names and you zero in on the Ethernet or the Wi-Fi, whatever. Point is, it's all here in a very approachable kind of non-scary graphical view, and it's just so useful. And the thing is, I keep speaking of it as if though the person that will be using this is the person who, you know, shouldn't really be on Linux and still is afraid to go over to console to type something in. But it's not. I mean, I use KInfoCenter all the time. Like, I use it just all the time for one reason or another, whether it's because I've momentarily forgotten how much memory I have in my system, or I've forgotten what version of KDE I'm running. All I ever remember about that is that it says it's the 25th anniversary edition when I go into my desktop. So I never can remember the numbers associated with it. I don't really use the network one very much, but possibly ever. But yeah, there are little bits of information, and especially the graphics card stuff. Like, that stuff is just it's so tedious to try to get that data from anywhere else. So just opening up KInfoCenter gives everything right there to you. It's parsed nicely, laid out nicely. It's just such a nice application. I love KInfoCenter. I believe every desktop should have KInfoCenter. And if you don't want KInfoCenter, then there should be an equivalent of that for GNOME. And there isn't, by the way. GNOME has system settings, which, by the way, from the name, makes it sound like it would be a place to go for system settings. So it has settings, and you can go there and glean a lot of information about your system. But you have to click around a lot and kind of go into places that, well, really, you could change stuff from. The KInfoCenter is not... It's not interactable. I mean, it is a little. You can click on buttons to change what you're looking at. But, I mean, you can't change that from here. You can't go to your network and accidentally bring your, you know, change your network selection. You can't change the state of your connection. You can't put your network down by looking at your network information. And I think there's a value to that. And I think that's really, really useful. That is KInfoCenter. Next, we're going to talk about KInit, which you would think, well, I guess that's another KDE application. It is not, except it also is. So KInit this is very confusing, but there are two applications technically called KInit. Not really, because this isn't called KInit. This is actually KDE Init, and specifically it provides KDE Init 5. And KDE Init 5 shutdown, KDE 5 init, no, KDE Init 5 wrapper. So the KDE Init is a process launcher similar to, you know, any init application. It initializes a thing. So this launches processes by forking them and then loading a dynamic library that has, it's kind of like you're almost preloading some of the essential things that KDE applications are going to require. In practice, like in everyday practice, I kind of feel like what this kind of does, and I don't even know if this is all that useful, but what you can do is if you're in a console, you can type in KDE init 5 and then the name of a KDE application, like KDE init 5 space Dolphin. Bang. It's open. And that forks that process. So you get it launches a new process. So you get your terminal prompt back. You still get output into the terminal. So it's not like you're losing anything there. And you get a little bit of a report on it, like what the process number for that is now. According to the man page, KDE init 5, where does it say here? Using KDE init 5 to launch KDE applications makes starting a typical KDE application a couple times faster and reduces memory consumption by a substantial amount. I have done my best to use KDE init 5 to launch applications over the past 2 weeks. And actually, it's been about 3 weeks now. And I couldn't tell you. Could not tell you. I cannot discern that they launch faster. I cannot discern whether they are using less memory. It's just not something. My computer has 32 gigs of RAM. It has so much RAM that I typically use a good chunk of it, usually 4 to 8 gigabytes, as a RAM disk where I put things like the data that I'm going to be using that day. I'll put copies of it into a RAM disk, and work off of those copies, like especially with like PDFs or big documents like that. I'll just copy them over to our RAM disks so I can just launch them from there, because they do launch so much faster from a RAM disk. But KDE Init 5, I have not noticed one at all, an improvement over performance, or in performance rather, because I was not suffering in the first place. So without a really scientific study of the benefits, I can't say whether or not this has made any difference to my computing life at all. But it's good to know about, and maybe it's something for you to try if you feel like things are lagging a little bit on your computer. Try KDE Init 5, see if that speeds up the launch times and reduces memory consumption, because it would sure be cool if it did. But yeah, personally, I've not noticed that myself. Okay, so KInit, the other KInit, which I'm not going to go over right now, is a Kerberos command, and you can use it to get a certificate from your Kerberos provider, so that then when you go to websites, you know, that are looking for a Kerberos certificate authentication, you have that cached on your system. So if you're signing into like a Fedora site or something where they can use that, like the build site for Fedora can use KInit to authenticate you as the as being the right person who has signed into that account and, you know, is trying to build an RPM against that account. So it's easy to confuse KInit with KInit from the package name. But this KInit is KDE Init 5. Kerberos's KInit is just KInit for real. Okay, now let's talk about KIO. So I've talked about KIO slivs before, and those are little library functions that extend what you can do with Dolphin. For instance, you insert a CD of music into a CD drive, and Dolphin interprets it as a collection of files, even though it's not files, it's just a bunch of audio data. But Dolphin understands that were you to extract a song from that CD, you would be doing that by turning it into a file, and so it represents that file to you. It is a fascinating way of interpreting data, and that's what some, you know, that's in general what KIO is all about. It's how it presents data to you. And KIO itself has, well, let me just read the description here. This framework implements almost all file management functions you ever need. In fact, the KDE File Manager, Dolphin, and the KDE File Dialog also use KIO to provide network-enabled file management. It supports accessing files locally as well as over HTTP and FTP, and it can be extended with other stuff, and there's more plugins available to support stuff such as SSH. So I think this probably more than anything, I could be wrong, but I kind of feel like this more than anything a long, long time ago really drove home for me that something like, for instance, HTTP especially, because I think that's the most magical one. This conveyed to me that HTTP, it's no different than anything else. You're just looking at files on a drive. The difference is that there are little hooks programmed in to some things, like a web browser, for instance, such that those files look different to you. They look, you're looking by default at the contents of the file rather than the icon, an icon representing that file. KIO in Dolphin brings full network transparency to your computer. So you can, for instance, type in fish, F-I-S-H, :// and then the address to some computer on your network, possibly preceded by your username, depending on how you've got your computer set up. So like fish, :// clat2 at 192.168.1.5. Hit return. You'll be prompted for a password for that computer. And you would type that in and hit return. And then as if though the files were located right there on the computer that you're sitting at, you see all the files in Dolphin. And you can use them. You can interact with them. You don't have to, like, copy them over to a local location. You can just start using them. And it is so, so convenient. I can't remember, really, the last time I bothered juggling files across my network anymore. I just open things up on a different computer on the screen that is most convenient to me. I'm sure there are exceptions. I use this as a convenience function. It's something that I do around the house when I need to look at a document or edit a text file. It's not something, you know, I'm not designing a whole workflow around it for a complex process. So there may be exceptions to how far this extends. But certainly for what I'm using it for, this has made my network a lot more cohesive than I feel I've had to work to make it feel. It has added quite a lot to my network that I never had to sit down and configure myself. It's just a reasonable network configuration, and KIO has brought me so much. And so it's really, really nice. If you're not using it, check it out, really, because it is just fantastic. So the package itself, KIO 5.90, provides the main protocols, like a protocol for, like, viewing your trash as a single location, FTP, for instance, automatic FTP. You don't have to go to a different application for that. It knows what to do with an HTTP application. It won't launch it straight into Dolphin. Dolphin is not Conqueror, but it will open it up in your default browser. Now, there are KIO-extras, which conveniently is the next one in the list, and that provides a bunch of other stuff, a bunch of other functions as well. For instance, fish, F-I-S-H, BZIP2. You don't have to do anything special for a BZIP2 document. You can just look at it. You don't have to open it up into something else. NFS, that's there as well. Man, info, XZ, Samba, TAR, just a lot of different things. Dolphin just kind of knows what to do with those things, depending on your configuration. So if you go to Dolphin, go to configure in the main menu, configure Dolphin. And then there is a place where you can choose certain functions. So there is, for instance, a place where you have to decide how you want to open up, for instance, archives. And there is an option to open archives directly in Dolphin, although I am not finding it right now as I speak. But trust me, it is there. You can just open up archives right within Dolphin as if though they were folders. I don't have that enabled. I actually prefer now for there to be a specific application, which we've covered in a previous episode called ARK, A-R-K. I prefer to open up my archives in ARK just because it does have a lot of functionality, and I just kind of like the idea that I have an application dedicated to in-depth, real-time usage of compressed files. So, yeah, here it is. Finally, navigation. Open new tabs after current tab. Open archives as folders. Open folders during drag-and-drop operations. So I have open archives as folders disabled. I do not have that enabled. That is left unchecked on mine. But you could do that, and then you would be using the KIO functionality of seamlessly introspecting and using and opening a compressed file as if though it was just a folder full of files. Oh, and I should mention too, I'm sorry, because I tend to focus on Dolphin because that's where I guess I mostly use this, but I mean, this is KDE Frameworks, right? This is all, there's integration here. So at any application that is KIO aware, you can use this same thing with those applications. So, for instance, let's say you're editing text in Kate and you want to edit a remote file. that happens not to be on your local computer. It's in the lap. It's on the laptop in the other room. You can just open that up from within Kate. GwynView is another one that's KIO aware. So there's several KDE applications that just give you KIO functionality for free thanks to the KIO subsystem. So that's KIO Extras. Is there anything else? KIO? Oh yeah, KIO G Drive. I think that's the last one. Okay, we'll end with that. KIO G Drive, as you might imagine, enables you to interact with a Google Drive straight within Dolphin. I try to avoid Google Drive. I do interact with Google Drive, but I not for personal information. So I don't actually use this, but you can try it. gdrive:// and then your username or your username at. And then I think, what is it? Something like the email address, probably. So I think just your email address, probably. Or something like that. I forget. Let me try with like a fake account here. Let me try this. So I'm going to put my user, a junk email address. That is, of course, Gmail, because those were easy to get at one point. And then I'll open it in Firefox to sign in. Because you have to let Akinati Resources for Google Services into your account. So I'm putting in my fake account name, and it recognizes that. And I put in the password, and then I've got two-factor authentication enabled, even for a fake account that I don't actually use. That's fine. Okay, so I'll get my little two-factor authentication token. I'm getting that. This is the kind of thing, by the way, Knit could help you with. I don't know how to use Knit with Google services because I don't interact with them that much, but it is possible. Okay, there we go. All right, so, I don't know that it's possible. What am I saying? But for other services, like if it's Kerberos-based, you can use Knit. Anyway, I'm in. Oh, and it looks like this has failed. It says this app is blocked. This app tried to access sensitive info in your Google account. To keep your account safe, Google blocked this access. So that did not function as I'd expected. Oh, well. Like I say, I don't really interact with Google services often. I try to avoid it when I can. It's handy for, you know, online accounts and things like that sometimes, but something I typically try to just ignore and avoid. So I don't know. I'm not going to spend time trying to figure that out because I don't care enough. But if you do use Google Drive, and many people do for school, for work, for whatever. So if you do use Google Drive, this could be something, or maybe Google's changed something on the back end. I suspect that I would have to just look up how to enable like application access for that Google account and then, you know, do something in the settings of Google to allow that application access. I guess. I don't really know. Maybe you need a developer token or something. Who knows? That's not a wonderful way to end this episode with failure. But I mean, sometimes that happens. And it's like I say, it's not really worth pursuing, I don't think. So that's KIO. Let's just focus on KIO, not on KIO G Drive. Who cares about G Drive? KIO, very, very cool system. Permeates a lot of KDE, so start using things remotely. It's easier than you might think. And type weird stuff into Dolphin's little URL bar. You never know what you'll find. It's a very cool system. And if you want to know what you'll find, have a look through the KIO packages on Slackware. It kind of explains it there. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.